It seems like everywhere you turn these days, it's all economy this and economy that. Inflation numbers, market dips,
Absolutely.
new government policies every other week.
It never ends.
I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like I'm just trying to grab at smoke.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So much information, so many experts saying completely opposite things. What if we could just like take a step back from all that noise for a second, you know?
I like where you're going with this.
And really try to understand the fundamental ideas that are actually at work behind all of it.
Get back to the roots of it all.
Exactly. Like that's kind of what we try to do here on the deep dive, right? Cut through all that noise and get to the core of things.
I think that's a perfect description of the show.
So that's exactly what we're going to do today.
Love it.
But we're going to do something a little bit different.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Instead of focusing on, you know, like what happened in the market today or what some politician said, we're going to take a deep dive into the work of one of the most influential economic thinkers of the 20th
Oh,
century,
I like this already.
Ludwig von Mises.
Now you're talking.
You familiar with his work?
Oh, yeah. Big time Mises was like a total legend. He was this Austrian economist who really challenged a lot of the mainstream economic thinking of his time.
So, like, what kind of stuff did he write about?
Oh, man. Where do I even begin? You've got Human Action, which is like his magnum opus, Nation, State, and Economy, The Theory of Money and Credit, Omnipotent Government, Planning for Freedom, Theory and History. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Wow. So we've got a lot of ground to cover today.
We've got a lot of Mises to unpack.
I think it would be helpful for our listeners if we kind of lay out, you know, what exactly we're going to be focusing on in this deep dive.
Yeah, for sure.
Our mission today is to really distill the essence of Mises' thought, right? Like,
Okay.
how did he understand the way markets work?
That's a big one.
What did he think about the role of money in the economy?
Absolutely essential.
And what are some of the potential dangers he saw in, you know, government intervention in the economy?
Another key theme in his work.
So we're basically trying to give our listeners a crash course in Misesian economics.
Mises 101, if you will.
Perfect. So where should we even begin with all of this? This guy wrote like a library's worth of stuff.
Well, I think the most logical place to start is with Mises' concept of human action.
Human action. Okay, what's that all about?
So for Mises, economics isn't about, like graphs and equations and all that stuff.
Right.
It's about something much more fundamental. It's about understanding how and why individuals act the way they do, particularly when it comes to using scarce resources.
So it's like psychology meets economics.
In a way, yeah, he saw every economic decision, every transaction we make, as stemming from a desire to go from a state of what he called uneasiness to a state that we perceive as more satisfactory.
Uneasiness. That's a pretty interesting way to put it.
Yeah.
So, like, if I'm hungry, that's a state of uneasiness, and I eat something to alleviate that uneasiness.
Oh, precisely. And it goes way beyond just basic needs like food or shelter. You could be uneasy because you want a new phone,
Right.
or, maybe you feel uneasy about the state of the world and you want to donate to charity.
Right. So it's really any kind of desire or want that motivates us to act.
Exactly. And that brings us to another crucial idea in Mises' thinking, the subjective nature of value.
Subjective value. So you're saying, like, what I think something is worth might be different from what you think it's worth.
That's exactly it. There's no objective universal scale for measuring the value of goods and services. It's all about how individuals perceive them and how much they're willing to give up to get them.
So, like, one person might be willing to pay a fortune for a first edition of their favorite book,
Right.
while someone else might think it's just an old piece of paper.
Exactly. And what makes it even more subjective is that the value we place on things changes all the time depending on our circumstances,
Totally. Like, if I'm starving, that first slice of pizza is going to be way more valuable to me than it would be after I've already eaten five slices.
It's all about context.
Okay, so we've got this idea of uneasiness driving us to act and this understanding that value is subjective and personal. But how do we actually make choices when we're faced with, you know, limited resources and unlimited wants? Like, how do we decide what to spend our money on or how to use our time?
So when we make choices, Mises said, we're not just, randomly picking things. We're actually assigning what he called orders of rank to portions of different means available to us.
Orders of rank, like ranking our options from best to worst.
Kind of, yeah. But it's more nuanced than that. We're not just saying, like, this thing is good and this thing is bad.
Okay.
We're saying, like, I value this specific amount of this thing more than this specific amount of that other thing.
Got it. So, like, I might value 2 hours of free time this afternoon.
Yeah.
More than an extra $100 in my paycheck.
Exactly. And these orders of rank are constantly changing based on, you know, our needs, our desires, the situation we're in.
Right. So it's not like we have this fixed list in our heads that never changes.
Not at all. It's a dynamic process. Importantly, Mises emphasized that we don't figure all this out in some abstract theoretical way. We figure it out through action, through actually making choices in the real world.
So by choosing one thing over another, we're revealing our preferences and our subjective valuations.
Exactly. Our actions speak louder than words when it comes to economics.
Now, I want to bring back this idea of uneasiness being the driver of action.
Sure.
Where does the entrepreneur fit into all of this?
Oh, the entrepreneur is absolutely essential in Mises' framework.
Okay, how so?
Their job is to constantly try and anticipate what consumers are going to want and need in the future.
Okay.
And then they invest their resources based on those predictions.
So they're kind of like fortune tellers in a way.
Kind of, yeah. But they're using their knowledge and their judgment to try and figure out what's going to alleviate the future uneasiness of consumers.
And how do they know if they've got it right?
That's where profit and loss come in. Profit is a signal that the entrepreneur has correctly anticipated consumer demand. They've created something that people actually want and are willing to pay for.
So profit is like a thumbs up from the market.
Exactly. It means you're doing something right. But on the flip side, losses signal that the entrepreneur has miscalculated. They've invested in something that people don't actually value as much as they thought they would.
So losses are like a thumbs down from the market.
Yeah. It's feedback telling them to adjust their course.
This is really interesting because it's kind of like a completely different way of looking at profit and loss.
Right.
Like, usually people think of profit as just being about making money.
Yeah.
But in Mises' view, it's really about serving consumers and satisfying their needs.
Exactly. Profit isn't just about lining your own pockets. It's a sign that you're actually creating value for others.
Now, all of this is happening within the context of the market.
Of course. The market is the arena where all these individual actions and choices play out.
So how did Mises understand the market? Like, what was his vision of how it actually works?
He saw the market as this incredibly complex, but also incredibly efficient process of coordinating the actions of countless individuals.
Okay.
Each person acting in their own self-interest, but in doing so, they're actually contributing to this larger web of cooperation and exchange.
It's almost like a self-organizing system.
That's a great way to put it. And the key to this whole process is the price system.
Prices. So like the price tags we see in stores.
Yeah, but it's much more than just that prices are signals. They convey information to producers about what consumers want, how much they want it, and how much they're willing to pay for it.
So prices are kind of like a language that the market uses to communicate.
That's a great analogy. Prices tell producers what to produce, how to produce it, and how much to produce.
It's amazing to think about how all of this is happening without any central planner or director.
Right. It's like this invisible hand guiding the whole process.
Now, I know Mises was a big critic of socialism, wasn't he?
He was a staunch defender of the free market and a pretty vocal opponent of socialism.
So where did he see the fundamental difference between a market economy and a socialist economy?
He believed they were totally incompatible, like oil and water. You can't have a truly stable system that's part free market and part centrally planned.
Why not?
Because the logic of each system undermines the other. In a market economy, production is guided by the decentralized decisions of millions of individuals responding to price signals.
Right.
But in a socialist economy, production is controlled by a central planning authority that tries to dictate what should be produced, how it should be produced, and who should get it.
So it's like a top-down versus bottom-up approach.
Exactly. And Mises argued that this top-down approach is doomed to fail because it ignores the vital role of prices and the information they convey.
Okay, so even if the central planners had the best intentions in the world,
yeah,
they would still run into problems because they wouldn't have the information they need to make efficient decisions.
Exactly. They would be flying blind, so to speak.
Now, I want to push back on this a little bit because some people might say, well, what about companies?
Okay.
Aren't they kind of like mini central planners within a market economy?
That's a good question. But here's the thing. Even the biggest corporations are ultimately beholden to consumers.
How so?
If they don't produce what people want at a price they're willing to pay, they're going to go out of business.
Right. They can't just dictate what people should buy.
No, they have to constantly adapt and innovate to stay ahead of the competition and keep their customers happy.
So in a sense, consumers are really the ones in charge in a market economy.
That's the beauty of it. The market is a system of consumer sovereignty. It's the consumers who ultimately decide what gets produced and how resources are allocated.
That's a pretty empowering thought.
It is, right. It puts the power in the hands of the people rather than in the hands of a select few planners or bureaucrats.
Now, I know Mises was also known for his critique of mathematical economics, wasn't he?
Yeah, he wasn't a big fan of using complex mathematical models to try and explain economic phenomena.
Why not? I mean, math seems like it would be a pretty useful tool for understanding economics.
Sure, on the surface it might seem that way, but Mises believed that this approach was fundamentally flawed.
Okay, in what way?
He argued that mathematical models are often based on unrealistic assumptions about human behavior, and they tend to ignore the dynamic and ever-changing nature of the market.
So, like, they're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole?
Kinda, yeah. They're trying to force this complex, messy reality into a neat and tidy mathematical formula.
What's the problem with that?
Well, for one thing, it can lead to a false sense of certainty. You know, like if you can model something with math, it makes it seem like you can predict the future with precision.
Right, like you've got it all figured out.
But Mises argued that the market is inherently unpredictable because it's driven by the choices of millions of individuals, each with their own unique motivations and circumstances.
So there's always an element of uncertainty.
Always. You can't just plug it all into an equation and get a definitive answer.
And was there anything else that he didn't like about mathematical economics?
Yeah, he was particularly critical of the focus on equilibrium in traditional economic theory.
Equilibrium.
Yeah, like the idea that the market is always tending towards this state of perfect balance where supply and demand are perfectly matched and prices are stable.
Okay.
Mises saw this as a kind of intellectual dead end. He argued that equilibrium is a useful concept for theoretical analysis, but it doesn't really exist in the real world.
Why not?
Because the market is constantly in flux. It's never truly at rest. There are always new discoveries, new technologies, new preferences emerging that are disrupting the status quo.
So it's more like a process of constant adjustment rather than a state of perfect balance.
Exactly. The market is dynamic and entrepreneurial, not static and predictable.
Okay, so we've talked about human action, the subjective nature of value, the role of the entrepreneur, the market process.
Yeah.
And Mises' critique of mathematical economics.
We've covered a lot of ground.
Now I want to dive into something that's absolutely essential to any modern economy.
I think I know where you're going with this.
Money.
Ah, yes. Yeah. The lifeblood of the economy.
Exactly. It seems like such a basic thing, but there's so much complexity underneath the surface.
Oh, absolutely. Money is one of those things that we use every day without really thinking about what it is or how it works.
Right. Like it's just this thing we carry around in our wallets or use to buy stuff online.
Yeah. But it's so much more than that. It's a fascinating topic. And Mises had some really insightful things to say about it.
So let's start with the basics.
Mm-hmm.
How did Mises explain the origins of money? Like, how did this thing that we all use and rely on come into existence?
He argued that money didn't just appear out of thin air. You know, it wasn't invented by some king or government decree.
Okay.
It emerged organically from the process of exchange as people tried to set the problem of barter.
Barter?
Yeah, like directly trading one good for another. So imagine you're a farmer and you have a surplus of wheat.
Okay.
And you want to trade it for, say, some shoes from a cobbler. But what if the cobbler doesn't need any wheat?
Right. That's a problem.
That's the inefficiency of barter. You have to find someone who has what you want and wants what you have. It can be a real hassle.
So how did money solve this problem?
Over time, people started to realize that certain goods were more widely accepted and more easily tradable than others.
Like what kind of goods?
Things like gold, silver, salt, livestock.
Yeah.
You know, things that were durable, portable, and divisible.
Okay, so these goods became kind of like intermediaries in the process of exchange.
Exactly. And eventually, one of these goods would emerge as the most commonly accepted medium of exchange, and that became money.
So it wasn't like someone just decided that gold was going to be money.
No, it was a spontaneous process driven by the needs and preferences of individuals in the market.
That's pretty amazing when you think about it.
It is. It's like this order emerging from chaos.
So once money came into existence, how did Mises understand his role in the economy?
He saw money as this crucial tool that facilitated exchange and made the whole market process much more efficient. Without money, we would be stuck in a world of barter, which would severely limit our ability to specialize and trade with each other.
Right. It would be like going back to the Stone Age.
Pretty much. So money allows us to escape that primitive state and unleash the incredible productivity of the market.
Now, I know Mises applied the principles of supply and demand to money, too, didn't he?
He did. He was a big believer in the quantity theory of money.
Which basically says that the more money there is in circulation,
the lower its value will be.
Right. So if you print too much money,
you get inflation.
Exactly. Prices go up and the purchasing power of money goes down.
Precisely. However, Mises had a very specific critique of what he called the holistic interpretation of the quantity theory of money.
Okay. I'm curious, what was his issue with that?
He argued that changes in the money supply don't affect all prices uniformly and simultaneously.
What do you mean?
When new money is injected into the economy, it doesn't just magically spread out evenly across all goods and services.
Okay.
It enters at a specific point and affects certain prices and industries first.
So there's like a ripple effect.
Exactly. And as this new money ripples through the economy, it creates distortions and misallocations.
How so?
Well, for one thing, it can lead to a misallocation of resources. Businesses start investing in projects that appear profitable based on the inflated prices, but those profits are illusory.
So they're making decisions based on bad information.
Exactly. They're being misled by the distorted price signals.
And what about consumers? How are they affected by this?
Well, as prices start to rise, the purchasing power of their savings is eroded.
Right, so they can't buy as much with the same amount of money.
Exactly. And this can lead to a decline in living standards, especially for those on fixed incomes.
So it's like a hidden tax on everyone who holds money.
That's a good way to put it. And Mises was very concerned about the inflationary tendencies of governments.
What do you mean?
He argued that throughout history, governments have had a strong incentive to inflate the currency.
Why would they do that?
Well, for one thing, it allows them to finance their spending without having to raise taxes.
So it's like a way of getting something for nothing?
In a way, yeah. But of course, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Eventually, the bill comes due in the form of higher prices and economic instability.
Now, we've been talking about money in kind of a general sense, but there are different forms that money can take, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole spectrum of different types of money.
So what were some of the key distinctions that Mises made?
He talked about commodity money, which is basically money that has intrinsic value because it's made of a valuable commodity like gold or silver.
Right. So like the gold coins that used to be in circulation.
Exactly. A gold has value even if it's not being used as money. You can use it for jewelry or industrial purposes.
So it's like double whammy. It's money, but it's also a valuable commodity in its own right.
Exactly. And this makes commodity money less susceptible to inflation because the government can't just print more gold.
Right. They have to actually mine it.
Which is a lot harder and more expensive than just running the printing presses.
Okay. So that's commodity money. Mm. What about the kind of money we use today?
So that's what Mises called fiduciary media.
Fiduciary media.
Yeah, it's basically money that doesn't have intrinsic value. It's just a claim on something else.
Like a promise to pay a certain amount of gold or silver.
Yeah, back in the day, that's what it used to be. But today, our money is fiat money.
Fiat money.
Yeah, it's backed by nothing but the government's decree.
So basically, they're just saying, trust us, this piece of paper is worth something.
Exactly. And as long as people have faith in the government and the stability of the currency, it works.
But what happens if that faith starts to erode?
That's when you get into dangerous territory. Mises was particularly concerned about what he called a crack-up boom.
A crack-up boom. That sounds pretty intense.
It is. It's basically a situation where people completely lose confidence in the currency. And they start frantically trying to get rid of it by buying any real goods they can get their hands on.
So it's like hyperinflation on steroids.
Yeah, it can lead to a complete collapse of the economy.
Okay, so we've got commodity money and fiduciary media.
Two sides of the coin.
What are some of the other key insights that Mises had about money?
Well, he emphasized that the value of money is determined by the same forces of supply and demand that determine the value of everything else.
Okay.
If the supply of money increases faster than the supply of goods and services, then you get inflation.
Right. Too much money chasing too few goods.
Exactly. And he was very critical of government intervention in the monetary system.
In what way?
He believed that central banks often make things worse by trying to manipulate interest rates and the money supply.
So he was more of a free market guy when it came to money, too.
Absolutely. He believed that the market was the best mechanism for allocating credit and determining the optimal supply of money.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground on money.
Yeah.
We talked about its origins, its role in the economy, the different forms it can take, and the dangers of inflation and government intervention.
Yeah, we've done a pretty thorough deep dive into Misesian monetary theory.
Now, I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about another important topic.
Sure.
Interest rates.
Ah, yes. The price of time.
What do you mean by that?
But interest rates basically reflect the fact that people generally prefer to to have things sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I offer you $100 today or $100 a year from now, which would you choose?
The $100 today, of course.
Exactly. And that's because there's a time value to money. We discount the future because there's always some uncertainty involved.
Things could change. You might not even be around a year from now.
Exactly. So interest rates capture this time preference. They're the premium that borrowers are willing to pay to have money now and that lenders demand for delaying their gratification.
Makes sense. Now, how did Mises understand the role of interest rates in the economy?
He saw them as a crucial coordinating mechanism. Right. They help to ensure that resources are allocated efficiently over time.
Okay, how so?
Well, interest rates signal the relative scarcity of capital. If interest rates are high, it means that capital is in high demand and businesses are willing to pay a lot to borrow it.
Okay, so high interest rates encourage saving and discourage borrowing.
Exactly. And if interest rates are low, it means that capital is relatively abundant and businesses are less eager to borrow.
So low interest rates encourage borrowing and discourage saving.
Precisely. And this is where Mises had a big problem with central banks.
What was his issue with them?
He argued that central banks often distort the natural interest rate by manipulating the money supply.
So they're messing with the signals that the market is trying to send.
Exactly. And this can lead to all sorts of problems.
Like what kind of problems?
Well, for one thing, it can lead to malinvestment.
Malinvestment?
Yeah. When businesses invest in projects that appear profitable based on the artificially low interest rates, but that wouldn't be profitable at the natural rate of interest.
So it's like they're building on a foundation of sand.
Exactly. It's unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, when interest rates rise back to their natural level, those malinvestments are exposed and you get a recession or a financial crisis.
Ouch, that doesn't sound good. So Mises was basically saying that central banks should just leave interest rates alone.
Pretty much. He believed that the market was much better at determining the appropriate level of interest rates than any central planner.
Now, this all ties back to his broader critique of government intervention in the economy, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. He was very skeptical of the ability of governments to improve upon the outcomes of the free market.
And this wasn't just about monetary policy, was it?
No, he had similar critiques of government intervention in other areas of the economy, like price controls, regulations, subsidies, tariffs, you name it.
So he was pretty much a laissez-faire economist.
Yeah, he believed that the government should play a very limited role in the economy, mainly focusing on protecting property rights, enforcing contracts, and maintaining a stable legal framework.
So create the rules of the game, but don't try to play the game itself.
Exactly. Let the market do its thing.
Now, one area where government intervention is often seen as necessary is in dealing with monopolies.
Yeah, monopolies are often seen as a threat to competition and consumer welfare.
So what was Mises' take on this?
He had a nuanced view of monopolies. He made a distinction between what he called a simple monopoly,
okay,
which is just a situation where there's only one supplier of a particular good or service.
Okay.
And monopoly prices, which are prices that are higher than they would be in a competitive market.
So just because there's only one supplier doesn't necessarily mean they're going to gouge consumers.
Exactly. A monopolist can only charge monopoly prices if they have a way of preventing competition from entering the market.
So like if there are barriers to entry.
Yeah, like high startup costs or government regulations that favor the incumbent.
So in Mises' view, the real problem isn't monopolies per se, but rather the conditions that allow them to charge monopoly prices.
Precisely. He argued that in a truly free market, without government intervention, monopolies would be much less of a problem.
Why is that?
Because new entrepreneurs would always be looking for opportunities to undercut the monopolist and offer consumers a better deal.
So competition would eventually erode the monopolist's power.
Exactly. The market has a way of self-correcting if you let it.
Now, this might seem counterintuitive to some people because we often hear about the dangers of big tech companies and how they're stifling competition.
Right.
But Mises would probably argue that a lot of those problems are actually caused by government intervention.
I think he would. He was very critical of things like patents and copyrights, which he saw as granting artificial monopolies to certain businesses.
So he would probably be in favor of less regulation in those industries.
I think so. He believed that the best way to promote competition was to get the government out of the way and let the market work its magic.
Okay, so we've covered monopolies. What about labor markets, another area where government intervention is pretty common?
Right. Minimum wage laws, labor unions, occupational licensing, all that stuff.
So what were Mises' thoughts on these kinds of interventions?
He was generally opposed to them. He believed that they distorted the natural functioning of the labor market and led to unintended negative consequences.
Like what kind of consequences?
Well, he argued that minimum wage laws, for example, actually harm the very people they're supposed to help. By raising the cost of labor, they make it more difficult for low-skilled workers to find jobs.
So it's like pricing them out of the market.
Exactly. And he had similar critiques of labor unions. He believed that while they could sometimes benefit their members in the short run, they ultimately hurt the economy as a whole by raising wages above their market level.
Which, again, makes it harder for businesses to hire workers.
Exactly. It creates a labor surplus, or what we call unemployment.
So Mises was basically saying that the best way to help workers is to let the market determine wages and working conditions.
Yeah, he believed that a free and competitive labor market would naturally lead to higher wages and better working conditions over time.
Now I want to shift gears again and talk about something a little bit different.
Okay.
Mises also wrote about the relationship between the nation, the state, and the economy.
He did. He was very interested in the historical development of these institutions and how they interacted with each other.
So what were some of his key insights in this area?
Well, he was a strong proponent of the classical liberal ideal, where the boundaries of the state coincide with the boundaries of the nation.
So like a nation state.
Exactly. Yeah. He believed that this was the most stable and just form of political organization.
Why is that?
Because it aligns the interests of the rulers with the interests of the ruled. If the state is composed of people who share a common language, culture, and history,
okay,
then they're more likely to have a sense of solidarity and to support the government.
Makes sense. But this wasn't just some abstract theoretical idea for Mises, was it?
No, he looked at specific historical examples like Great Britain and France, where the development of national unity was closely linked to the rise of liberalism and limited government.
So he saw a connection between national identity and individual liberty.
Exactly. He believed that a strong sense of national identity could actually promote individual liberty by providing a counterweight to the power of the state.
Interesting. Yeah. So he wasn't a nationalist in the sense of, you know, like my country, right or wrong.
No, he was a liberal who believed in individual rights and limited government. But he also recognized the importance of national identity as a force for good.
You know, I know Mises was writing in the early to mid 20th century,
yeah,
a time of great upheaval in Europe.
Absolutely. World wars, revolutions, the rise of totalitarian ideologies.
So how did he view the events of his time through this lens of nation, state, and economy?
He was very critical of both nationalism and socialism. He saw them as threats to individual liberty and peace.
Okay, how so?
Well, he believed that nationalism often led to wars and conflicts between nations as each group sought to assert its dominance over others.
Right, like the kind of aggressive nationalism that led to World War I.
Exactly. And he saw socialism as a form of economic nationalism where the state sought to control the means of production and distribution for the benefit of its own citizens at the expense of others.
So it's like a zero-sum game where one nation's gain is another nation's loss.
That's how he saw it. And he argued that both nationalism and socialism were ultimately incompatible with a peaceful and prosperous world order.
So what was his solution?
He believed that the only way to achieve lasting peace and prosperity was through a system of free trade, limited government, and individual liberty.
So basically, classical liberalism applied on a global scale.
Exactly. He saw this as the only way to break down the barriers between nations and create a world where everyone could benefit from the fruits of their labor.
Now, this all ties back to his critique of socialism, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. He saw socialism as both an economic and a political threat. He argued that it was inherently inefficient and that it would inevitably lead to tyranny.
So let's dive into his critique of socialism a little bit more.
Yeah.
We touched on it earlier, but I think it deserves a deeper exploration.
I agree. It's one of the most important aspects of Mises' work.
So what was his central argument against socialism?
His main argument was that socialism is impossible to implement in practice because it makes rational economic calculation impossible.
Rational economic calculation.
Yeah, it's basically the ability to compare costs and benefits and make rational decisions about how to allocate resources.
Okay. And Mises argued that without a free market for the means of production, you can't have rational economic calculation.
Why not?
Because in a socialist economy, the government owns and controls all the factories, the farms, the mines, everything.
Right.
So there's no market for those things. There are no prices being formed for them.
Okay.
And without prices, you have no way of knowing what things are actually worth, how much they cost to produce, or how scarce they are.
So it's like trying to bake a cake without a recipe.
Exactly. You have all the ingredients,
yeah,
but you have no idea how much of each one to use or how long to bake it for.
And this applies to all kinds of goods and services, not just physical things, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It applies to everything. Labor, okay. Capital, land, raw materials, you name it.
So even if the socialist planners had the best intentions in the world,
yeah,
and they really wanted to create a society where everyone was equal and had their needs met,
they would still run into this fundamental problem of not being able to make rational economic decisions.
Because they wouldn't have the information they need to make those decisions. Exactly. They would be flying blind and the results would be disastrous.
Now, I know some people might argue that, well, you could still have some kind of planning even without a market.
Yeah, like you could use computers to collect data and try to simulate market prices.
Right.
But Mises argued that this wouldn't work either because it ignores the crucial role of human judgment and entrepreneurship.
Okay, how so?